Time once again on this Saturday morning for a wine chat with our friend from Haskell's, Jack Farrell. Good morning, Jack.
Hi there, Denny. How are you this morning?
I'm doing well on this final, hard to believe, final weekend of June.
Yes, it looks like we might get sun all day.
Absolutely, and a beautiful day tomorrow.
Yes, we deserve it. And yes. Speaking of deserving things, I thought today would be a good idea to talk about, because of the 4th of July coming up, etc., just about the history of winemaking in America. You know, a lot of people don't think wine is much of anything here. Well, that's changed. It wasn't much of anything, in spite of the fact when it was originally discovered by the Vikings, it was called Vinland because there were vines everywhere, grapevines. It was just incredible. But unfortunately, as our forefathers found out, those grapevines didn't translate into very good wine. Native American wines just weren't cutting. They had flavors that people didn't like. As a matter of fact, the first vineyard plantings in the United States, believe it or not, were not in our colonial area. It was in about 1640, and it was around New Mexico. And it was some of the Spanish that had moved in there. People from Spain had planted some vineyards in New Mexico. But today, the Spanish that had moved in there, people from Spain had planted some vineyards in New Mexico. But today, we can take our place alongside anybody in the world when it comes to wine. It's been a tumble and a rough trip, but it really has paid off. Today, America is the largest consumer of fine wine in the world. No one is even close, because we've got a lot more people than most wine-consuming and wine-drinking countries do have. But nonetheless, in volume and what we produce, we're the third largest producer of wines in the entire world, and there's no question about it, but California's University of Davis is the fountainhead for all wine information for everybody in the world. I mean, it's a highly regarded school, and anybody who can afford it wants to send their children there for a semester or two, whether they're from Australia or they're from Bohemia, or they're from France. They want to go to California and learn about the latest tech about wines, and that's where we really just are stellar performers. But this was not easy to come about. You know, our forefathers drank a lot of wine, but it was all imported. They drank, they were heavy to Madeira and port, but which are fortified wines. You have to have a distillery to produce those wines, because brandy or neutral spirits is added to stop the fermentation and the production of sherry and of port. But anyhow, Thomas Jefferson wrote a wonderful book about traveling to Europe, looking for vines and vineyards to plant. And he went from Bordeaux to Burgundy, down to the Piedmont area of Italy, sending back cuttings to his home, where he tried to grow grapes, and they just weren't very successful at all with those fine European grape stocks in his part of Virginia. And so the onset wasn't very good. They all tried it and really didn't kind of catch on until they discovered a native grape called Catawba. And the Catawba grape made a halfway decent sparkling wine, which became a very popular about 1840, and that Catawba was grown mainly in Ohio, and as it spread out, it went to the Finger Lakes district of New York, etc., and a fledgling wine industry got started there. But of course, something was about to rear its ugly head, and that something is called Prohibition. And Prohibition didn't come about just overnight. It was enacted in 1919, but for years there were dry states and dry counties, et cetera, et cetera. They tried to do that, and it wasn't really until the dries, who wanted prohibition, teamed up with the women suffragettes who wanted the right to vote, that they formed an alliance, and they got women the right to vote, and then the Dries prevailed with the Volstead Act, and of course, we're from Minnesota, and that's where Volstead was from. We have the distinction of having our congressman, who was the one who sponsored the bill for prohibition, called the Volstead Act. Now, the Volstead Act was a difficult pill for winemakers to swallow. It destroyed the wine industry in California. However, it did not destroy the grape-growing industry in California, because a lot of, particularly the immigrants coming into this country in the early 1900s, figured that they had to have wine with their meals. And the Volstead Act, incidentally, allows you to make 300 gallons of wine for home consumption a year. And that's still in effect. Anybody who would like to can make at home 300 gallons of wine, and you don't pay any taxes. However, taxes on wine are really very minuscule. They're only not even a dollar. With state and federal, they're under a few dollars a case. So it's a very minuscule amount, considering at one time liquor taxes paid all the bills in the early United States. That was their largest source of revenue, was liquor taxes. But at any rate, I'm digressing. What those immigrants wanted were grapes from California, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. And they needed grapes that had tough skins, produced red wine, and could make that arduous train trip. It took about 5 days for a train to go from San Francisco to, say, New York. And so you had to have grapes that could withstand that and not show up as a carload full of mush or smashed grapes. So they planted all of these grape types that were very hardy skinned and produced robust red wine, but really weren't that unique and delicious. But at any rate, so we had got in wine production all the way up to Finger Lakes and all that. That was in the 1840s. But something happened in 1849 called the Gold Rush, and it sent people streaming out to California, all sorts of new immigrants looking to make their way in the new country, etc. And, of course, some of those immigrants brought with them a desire to have wine instead of just whiskey and beer and cider, which were the predominant drink. You know, at that time, maybe the wine of the spirits category was 1.5 to 2%. The rest was cider, beer, and whiskey. So those immigrants wanted some wine. And, of course, California, because of the early mission system where they built missions all the way from San Diego on up to Sacramento, and they, of course, being a mission, they had to make wine for sacramental purposes, and those monks planted grapes. And grape growing was flourishing in Mexico because of the Spanish background, and they had mission grapes, which again were okay, but not really the high quality they wanted. But these miners that came out that didn't strike gold decided they'd stay. They liked the temperature, they liked the California weather, etc., and they stayed on, and they developed a fledgling wine business there because it was a lot like the climate was more Mediterranean than those places like Finger Lakes and Ohio and the Erie Islands, etc., where they were growing Catawba, and they found that Catawba didn't do so well there. So in California, some of the miners struck out. One of the early ones was a fellow by the name of Anton Hazarsky, and he's known as the father of the California wine business. Surprisingly, not Junipero Serra, who started all those missions, each and every one of them, and planted the vineyards. Hazarsky came from Hungary, and whether he was a count or not, he billed himself as a count. And he started Buena Vista Winery in Sonoma Valley. And one of his employees was Charles Krug. And Charles LaFranc, in 1852, started a vineyard called Almaden. And his son-in-law went on to establish a vineyard called Paul Masson. So we see these things starting, but Anton Hazarsky was really the guy. And if you go to Buena Vista in Sonoma today, the Boisset family from France owns it, and their son, John Charles Boisset, who's quite a showman, has created a Count Hazarsky, and he stops in and chats with people at the tasting room at Buena Vista, and you can even go there, I think, in the summer. They have four or five festivals which feature the Count and music, etc., and make Buena Vista interesting vineyard to visit in Sonoma Valley. But anyhow, that's where the wineries got started, and they were doing real well. In fact, surprisingly, and at the turn of the century, in 1889, there was an exhibition in France where the California wines took over half of the medals. And but, you know, within a decade, they were all shut down by that beast that we know as Prohibition. And Prohibition knocked all of the really good winemakers out of the business because there was no market. They couldn't sell their wine, even though wine could be sold. So the growers flourished in Prohibition, grape growers who grew those hardy grapes that could be shipped to the eastern markets to make wine. But the actual vineyards, etc., were closed down because you couldn't sell wine commercially. However, there's, again, that funny loophole where you could make 300 gallons a year. Was also interesting in those days that it was not illegal to drink. It was just illegal to commercially buy or sell spirits. And anyhow, fast forward, after Prohibition, what a slow struggle. In fact, as I said earlier, you know, one of the things that stopped entirely in Prohibition was the production of fortified wines. Fortified wines are like sherry and port, etc., because you need to distill spirits to do that. Well, right after Prohibition in California, almost 90% of the production was fortified wines, ports and sherries and things like that. And table wine was a very, very small percentage. And there were always a few people who wanted to see that improve, and it wasn't until 1976 when the big Paris tasting compared all the California wines to some French wines, really top French wines, and the California wines just zinged them, absolutely took every single spot. The number one one was California wine, and of course Bob Mondavi felt very vindicated by that because he had been preaching for the last 30 years how California should be considered one of the great wine-producing areas of the entire world. And, of course, today, indeed, it is. And that changed everything. Then in about 1991, 60 Minutes ran a special on heart and being heart healthy. And they determined in France, everyone who ate real fatty foods and did not exercise and still had low incidence of heart trouble. And in fact, if you took it further, the Italians have the lowest incidence of heart difficulty in all of Western Europe, and they're the largest consumers of wine in Western Europe. But anyhow, so all of a sudden we were off to the races. People started to drink wine and look at it. Of course, that didn't happen real quickly. What really happened was after World War II, a lot of those soldiers went over there to Europe and got the idea of having wine with their meals and kind of liked it. And then in the 60s, air travel became affordable for everybody, and you could go and tour Europe on a holiday from the 60s on. And that's what really caused the wine explosion in this country. So we've come a long way from the Vinland of the Vikings, and the poor Jefferson would be very proud of himself because today there's a bonded winery in every single state of the Union, including Alaska and Hawaii, and that is a remarkable thing in my opinion. Anyhow, it's a great way to celebrate the 4th of July with a glass of wine and think how far we've come and how far we still have to go in this country, because we are definitely a great wine-producing country, and we're a great wine-producing nation. And, well, that's my 4th of July story.
Oh, what a great story. And our listeners loving it, sending texts that they love the show today, especially because of that. So, and how thrilling it is, and how much easier it is these days to visit any one of the Haskell's locations.
Indeed. The Haskell's love to talk about wine. They have our summer sale has just started yesterday, so we've got loads and loads of wine on sale. Don't miss Ted Farrell's special 4th of July BOGO. He's got 6 for 60, 6 bottles of wine, $60, and he has a marvelous Zinfandel, a great Pinot Noir. In fact, the Pinot Noir is a $30 bottle of wine that's in this 6 for 60, and a great Chardonnay that's lightly oaked. Unbelievable, 6 bottles of wine for your 4th of July celebration for $60, and it's available at all the Haskell stores. Another interesting thing is you might want to take a boat ride. Our July 13th boat ride on the beautiful St. Croix River. Lots of wines and beers and spirits to taste and try, and including a lovely lunch. And the scenery is spectacular. But meanwhile, there's a Haskell's near you where you can save big dollars on the wine. Bloomington has one. There's a Haskell's in Excelsior, Fairbrook, right off at 35. In Maple Grove, the super cellar is 22,000 square feet of wines from around Excelsior, Fairbrook, right off at 35. In Maple Grove, the super cellar is 22,000 square feet of wines from around the world. We have free parking on downtown on Saturday and Sunday. There's a Haskell's in Minnetonka, Plymouth, St. Paul's Highland Village, Stillwater, White Bear Lake, and Woodbury, too. And don't forget, if you can't come in, go to Haskell's.com. And we do deliver.
Very good. Jack, happy 4th to you and all the good folks at Haskell's and our listeners, too. And let's meet up again next week.
You know, Denny, I'm going to look forward to that.
Jack Farrell from Haskell's. Time once again on this Saturday morning for a wine chat with our friend from Haskell's, Jack Farrell. Good morning, Jack.
Hi there, Denny. How are you this morning?
I'm doing well on this final, hard to believe, final weekend of June.
Yes, it looks like we might get sun all day.
Absolutely, and a beautiful day tomorrow.
Yes, we deserve it. And
yes.
Speaking of deserving things, I thought today would be a good idea to talk about, because of the 4th of July coming up, etc., just about the history of winemaking in America. You know, a lot of people don't think wine is much of anything here. Well, that's changed. It wasn't much of anything, in spite of the fact when it was originally discovered by the Vikings, it was called Vinland because there were vines everywhere, grapevines. It was just incredible. But unfortunately, as our forefathers found out, those grapevines didn't translate into very good wine. Native American wines just weren't cutting. They had flavors that people didn't like. As a matter of fact, the first vineyard plantings in the United States, believe it or not, were not in our colonial area. It was in about 1640, and it was around New Mexico. And it was some of the Spanish that had moved in there. People from Spain had planted some vineyards in New Mexico. But today, the Spanish that had moved in there, people from Spain had planted some vineyards in New Mexico. But today, we can take our place alongside anybody in the world when it comes to wine. It's been a tumble and a rough trip, but it really has paid off. Today, America is the largest consumer of fine wine in the world. No one is even close, because we've got a lot more people than most wine-consuming or wine-drinking countries do have. But nonetheless, in volume and what we produce, we're the third largest producer of wines in the entire world. And there's no question about it, but California's University of Davis is the fountainhead for all wine information for everybody in the world. I mean, it's a highly regarded school and anybody who can afford it wants to send their children there for a semester or two, whether they're from Australia or they're from Bohemia or they're from France. They want to go to California and learn about the latest tech about wines, and that's where we really just are stellar performers. But this was not easy to come about. You know, our forefathers drank a lot of wine, but it was all imported. They drank, they were heavy to Madeira and port, but which are fortified wines. You have to have a distillery to produce those wines, because brandy or neutral spirits is added to stop the fermentation and the production of sherry and of port. But anyhow, Thomas Jefferson wrote a wonderful book about traveling to Europe looking for vines and vineyards to plant. And he went from Bordeaux to Burgundy down to the Piedmont area of Italy, sending back cuttings to his home where he tried to grow grapes, and they just weren't very successful at all with those fine European grape stocks in his part of Virginia. And so the onset wasn't very good. They all tried it and really didn't kind of catch on until they discovered a native grape called Catawba. And the Catawba grape made a halfway decent sparkling wine, which became a very popular about 1840. And that Catawba was grown mainly in Ohio. And as it spread out, it went to the Finger Lakes District of New York, etc. And a fledgling wine industry got started there. But, of course, something was about to rear its ugly head, and that something is called Prohibition. And Prohibition didn't come about just overnight. It was enacted in 1919, but for years there were dry states and dry counties, etc., etc. They tried to do that, and it wasn't really until the dries, who wanted Prohibition, teamed up with the women suffragettes who wanted the right to vote, that they formed an alliance, and they got women the right to vote, and then the dries prevailed with the Volstead Act. And, of course, we're from Minnesota, and that's where Volstead was from. We have the distinction of having our congressman, who was the one who sponsored the bill for Prohibition, called the Volstead Act. Now, the Volstead Act was a difficult pill for winemakers to swallow. It destroyed the wine industry in California. However, it did not destroy the grape-growing industry in California, because a lot of, particularly the immigrants coming into this country in the early 1900s, figured that they had to have wine with their meals. And the Volstead Act, incidentally, allows you to make 300 gallons of wine for home consumption a year. And that's still in effect. Anybody who would like to can make at home 300 gallons of wine, and you don't pay any taxes. However, taxes on wine are really very minuscule. They're only not even a dollar. With state and federal, they're under a few dollars a case. So it's a very minuscule amount, considering at one time, liquor taxes paid all the bills in the early United States. That was their largest source of revenue, was liquor taxes. But at any rate, I'm digressing. What those immigrants wanted were grapes from California, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. And they needed grapes that had tough skins, produced red wine, and could make that arduous train trip. It took about 5 days for a train to go from San Francisco to, say, New York. And so you had to have grapes that could withstand that and not show up as a carload full of mush or smashed grapes. So they planted all of these grape types that were very hardy skinned and produced robust red wine, but really weren't that unique and delicious. But at any rate, so we had got in wine production all the way up to Finger Lakes and all that. That was in the 1840s. But something happened in 1849 called the Gold Rush, and it sent people streaming out to California, all sorts of new immigrants looking to make their way in the new country, etc. And, of course, some of those immigrants brought with them a desire to have wine instead of just whiskey and beer and cider, which were the predominant drink. You know, at that time, maybe the wine of the spirits category was 1.5 to 2%. The rest was cider, beer, and whiskey. So those immigrants wanted some wine, and of course, California, because of the early mission system where they built missions all the way from San Diego on up to Sacramento, and they, of course, being a mission, they had to make wine for sacramental purposes, and those monks planted grapes, and grape growing was flourishing in Mexico because of the Spanish background, and they had mission grapes, which again were okay, but not really the high quality they wanted. But these miners that came out that didn't strike gold decided they'd stay. They liked the temperature, they liked the California weather, etc., and they stayed on, and they developed a fledgling wine business there because it was a lot like the climate was more Mediterranean than those places like Finger Lakes and Ohio and the Erie Islands, etc., where they were growing Catawba, and they found that Catawba didn't do so well there. So in California, some of the miners struck out. One of the early ones was a fellow by the name of Anton Hazarsky, and he's known as the father of the California wine business. Surprisingly, not Junipero Serra, who started all those missions, each and every one of them, and planted the vineyards. Hazarsky came from Hungary, and whether he was a count or not, he billed himself as a count. And he started Buena Vista Winery in Sonoma Valley. And one of his employees was Charles Krug. And Charles LaFranc, in 1852, started a vineyard called Almaden. And his son-in-law went on to establish a vineyard called Paul Masson. So we see these things starting, but Anton Hazarsky was really the guy. And if you go to Buena Vista in Sonoma today, the Boisse family from France owns it, and their son, John Charles Boisse, who's quite a showman, has created Count Hazarsky, and he stops in and chats with people at the tasting room at Buena Vista, and you can even go there, I think, in the summer. They have four or five festivals which feature the Count and music, etc., and make Buena Vista interesting vineyard to visit in Sonoma Valley. But anyhow, that's where the wineries got started, and they were doing real well. In fact, surprisingly, at the turn of the century, in 1889, there was an exhibition in France where the California wines took over half of the medals. And but, you know, within a decade, they were all shut down by that beast that we know as Prohibition. And Prohibition knocked all of the really good winemakers out of the business because there was no market. They couldn't sell their wine, even though wine could be sold. So the growers flourished in Prohibition, grape growers who grew those hardy grapes that could be shipped to the eastern markets to make wine. But the actual vineyards, etc., were closed down because you couldn't sell wine commercially. However, there's, again, that funny loophole where you could make 300 gallons a year. It was also interesting in those days that it was not illegal to drink. It was just illegal to commercially buy or sell spirits. And anyhow, fast forward, after Prohibition, what a slow struggle. In fact, as I said earlier, you know, one of the things that stopped entirely in Prohibition was the production of fortified wines. Fortified wines are like sherry and port, etc., because you need to distill spirits to do that. Well, right after Prohibition in California, almost 90% of the production was fortified wines, ports and sherries and things like that. And table wine was a very, very small percentage. And there were always a few people who wanted to see that improve. And it wasn't until 1976 when the big Paris tasting compared all the California wines to some French wines, really top French wines, and the California wines just zinged them. Absolutely took it. Every single spot, the number one was California wine. And, of course, Bob Mondavi felt very vindicated by that because he had been preaching for the last 30 years how California should be considered one of the great wine-producing areas of the entire world. And, of course, today, indeed, it is. And that changed everything. Then in about 1991, 60 Minutes ran a special on heart and being heart healthy. And they determined in France, everyone who ate real fatty foods and did not exercise and still had low incidence of heart trouble, and in fact, if you took it further, the Italians have the lowest incidence of heart difficulty in all of Western Europe, and they're the largest consumers of wine in the Western Europe. But anyhow, so all of a sudden we were off to the races. People started to drink wine and look at it. Of course, that didn't happen real quickly. What really happened was after World War II, a lot of those soldiers went over there to Europe and got the idea of having wine with their meals and kind of liked it. And then in the 60s, air travel became affordable for everybody, and you could go and tour Europe on a holiday from the 60s on, and that's what really caused the wine explosion in this country. So we've come a long way from the Vinland of the Vikings, and the poor Jefferson would be very proud of himself, because today there's a bonded winery in every single state of the Union, including Alaska and Hawaii, and that is a remarkable thing in my opinion. Anyhow, it's a great way to celebrate the 4th of July with a glass of wine and think how far we've come and how far we still have to go in this country, because we are definitely a great wine-producing country and we're a great wine-producing nation. And, well, that's my 4th of July story.
Oh, what a great story. And our listeners loving it, sending texts that they love the show today, especially because of that. So, and how thrilling it is and how much easier it is these days to visit any one of the Haskell's locations.
Indeed. The Haskell's love to talk about wine. They our summer sale has just started yesterday, so we've got loads and loads of wine on sale. Don't miss Ted Farrell's special 4th of July BOGO. He's got six for 60, six bottles of wine, $60. And he has a marvelous Zinfandel, a great Pinot Noir. In fact, the Pinot Noir is a $30 bottle of wine that's in this six for 60. And a great Chardonnay that's lightly oaked. Unbelievable. Six bottles of wine for your 4th of July celebration for $60. And it's available at all the Haskell stores. Another interesting thing is you might want to take a boat ride. Our July 13th boat ride on the beautiful St. Croix River. Lots of wines and beers and spirits to taste and try, and including a lovely lunch. And the scenery is spectacular. But meanwhile, there's a Haskell's near you where you can save big dollars on the wine. Bloomington has one. There's a Haskell's in Excelsior, Fairbrook, right off at 35. And Maple Grove, the super cellar, is 22,000 square feet of wines from around. Excelsior Fairbrook, right off at 35, and Maple Grove, the super cellar, is 22,000 square feet of wines from around the world. We have free parking on downtown on Saturday and Sunday. There's a Haskell's in Minnetonka, Plymouth, St. Paul's Highland Village, Stillwater, White Bear Lake, and Woodbury, too. And don't forget, if you can't come in, go to Haskell's.com, and we do deliver.
Very good. Jack, happy 4th to you and all the good folks at Haskell's and our listeners, too. And let's meet up again next week.
You know, Denny, I'm going to look forward to that.
Jack Farrell from Haskell's.